So I've been here long enough to see, I want to say there's at least 4 Hall of Famers. And I try to look at the work ethic of those guys and how they grinded every day and the level of competitiveness they had. And I try to push the other guys to that level. And maybe it's wrong, but for me, it's like, that's my expectation. My expectation is the Hall of Famer. And if you have the player at the end of the bench working as hard as the Hall of Famer, they're not going to be the Hall of Famer probably, but they're going to be a lot better than they were to start with. And that's where I think my biggest disagreement with some guys is when they don't push themselves to reach their full potential.
What's up, y'all? Welcome back to Shipped Across the Border.
My name is Max. I'm here with Chris, and today we have on probably the most anticipated guest we've had on this podcast.
What?
Probably going to get the most views out of our teammates on this podcast.
Okay.
Fan favorite, Coach P, assistant coach of Elms Basketball. Now, before we get into the episode, remember to follow us on Instagram at SATB_pod, TikTok at Ships Across the Border, and subscribe, like, share, send to your grandma, send to your mom, send to your coach, and we're going to get into it. So, Coach P, what's going on?
Not much. How are you guys?
I'm good. How do you pronounce your last name? Because I've seen you have a different name on your Instagram than you do on the website. So I was hella confused. that's what I was going to lead with.
It's Plamondon. The way it spells out. Yeah. Okay. But I don't know about fan favorite. That would be who you asked.
Why do you say fan favorite?
Probably 10% of the guys that have been here would say that I'm their favorite, and the other 90 would give you a mixed review.
Why do you say fan favorite?
That's what I was referring to.
Oh, the mixed reviews. Okay. So basically, how I want to start this is the layout of this. I want to go through some background, who you are, some how you grew up, and then into like your basketball career, and then into the coaching career, and then afterwards some lessons and stuff like that. So basically, where are you from? What are some childhood experiences and stories that shaped who you are today?
All right. So I grew up in Agawam, Mass. It's about 10 minutes from here. And I started playing basketball right around 5th grade. Dad never played basketball. Mom didn't play basketball. It was just kind of just started learning. Dad did the best he could to teach me. Mm-hmm. And it was more the values that he taught me were what I carried into basketball more than the skill that he taught me. Mm-hmm. Just how to be a hard worker, how always to, when you're on the court, do the best you can defensively, do the best you can with effort, and those are the things that will eventually carry you on. Mm-hmm. From there, I ended up playing at Agawam High School. I played for 3 seasons at Agawam. Like I said, it was a grind. I was not the best basketball player in the world growing up. I was solely on varsity. You can ask any of my teammates just by how hard I worked and how hard I grinded, and there was no way that I would let the coaches cut me. I just worked at that level. I had, you know, some great coaches. I had a high school coach, Hassan Robinson, who played professionally for the Houston Astros. He also instilled in me hard work. He kept me balanced and kept me grounded. I'll never forget when I was on JV, he was still the JV coach, and it was my sophomore year. We were playing at Central High School, and I hit a half-court shot and did the Walker Wiggle. This is when Antoine Walker was a Boston Celtic. I did the Walker Wiggle and ran into the locker room. And when I got back in the locker room, he sat me down, and I've never been screamed at that loud in my life, and told me, do you realize we're down by 30? And I didn't see the floor of the second half. But that was like a lesson, but it was also like one of those things like, at that moment, that kind of made me want to be a coach. Like the way he handled me and the things I learned from him, it pushed me to want to be where I am now.
What position were you?
So I wanted to be a guard. I was more of a forward. I played at a high school where like 6'3" was a center. Mm-hmm. So, and I was 5'11", so I was more the forward, and we had a lot of little guys. Agawam was not known for basketball. Yeah, it was. My dreams were to be a guard, but I did not have the guard skills.
Did you have any interest in playing post-secondary basketball? Did you end up playing post-secondary basketball?
No. So I actually ended up going to Stick. My high school coach ended up taking over the baseball program. What? So I ended up playing baseball for 2 years in college.
Did you play baseball in high school as well?
No. So when I was, I want to say 7 years old, I was climbing up one of the slides at the park, the big yellow slides.
Yeah.
And my dad went around the front, and I fell backwards from the top and shattered my arm. Dang. So I have a humongous scar on my arm. And it just was there were points in my high school career was just too painful. I was a pitcher. When I went to college, coach talked me into trying out and playing, and I really enjoyed it. You know, I don't know if I enjoyed the academic piece, but I loved the baseball piece. But yeah, that's the whole story. Basketball wasn't an option for college, but baseball was. So I played 2 years there.
That's dope.
What did you do after you finished that season of baseball at Steck, the second season?
So as I said before, school was not my thing. And that's what I stress. I teach high school right now for math at Central. I stress academics was not my thing. I did not like school. I did everything to avoid school. I don't know if you've heard of Eric Thomas, and he talks about how it took him 20 years to get a 4-year degree. No. So Eric Thomas is a motivational speaker. Okay. My story kind of fits his story. I did not like school and had no interest in finishing college after my 2 years at Stick. In 2007 or 8, I had the opportunity to come here. And Coach Silva, who was the coach at the time, sat me down. And when he offered me the opportunity to come onto the staff, it was kind of a requirement that I had to finish my education.
How did he – were you coaching at other places previously, or he just, like, you knew him? Or how did you – being a college basketball – I feel like that's a big jump, there's a little gap in that.
It is. So I'll start back where when I was 19 years old. I got a phone call that a job at Westfield High School had opened up. Okay. For the freshman position. I'm 19. I'm in my second year at Stick because I started college when I was 17. And position opens up. So I go for the interview. I'm only 19. You know, I'm out at the clubs, and some of the girls that are like cheerleaders on the team are out at the same clubs as me. And I'm like, I'm 19 years old. But because of some recommendations and the hard work that I put in high school, I was offered the opportunity to start coaching. I was a freshman coach there for 3 seasons, and then was offered my first varsity basketball position. And this is kind of ties into the low point of my career. I coached at a school called St. Mary's High School, which is a small Catholic school in Westfield, which is also about 10, 15 minutes from here. And first season, great season. I think we missed the playoffs by a game, but for the program, that was a good accomplishment. The second season was by far our best season, and the best season they'd had in a while. Great group of guys. We excelled, and expectations were met. And I think we finished, I want to say, 13-7, 14-6 range. When that season ended, the administration and I sat down, and we just had different views of what the program was going to look like. Being a small Catholic school, they wanted everyone to play equally. I wanted the best players to play. And my values were that you have to work for playing time. Like, I believe 50-50 is that's little kid stuff, sure, in my opinion. So we parted ways. You know, a low point. I was super excited. My first varsity job, I'm, you know, mid-20s, early 20s, I think, like maybe 23, 24. I'm like, wow, this is a great opportunity. So I'm sitting at home. Nothing's going on. Next high school season rolls around. I get a phone call, again, just based on, you know, my freshman coaching and high school experience. I get a phone call from one of my former coaches, and he's like, hey, are you interested in coaching high school basketball again as an assistant at a Springfield school, which is obviously a step up. So it's a school called SciTech. I don't know if you've...
Yeah, I have heard of that, just from, like, the team bantering about, like, different high schools in the area.
Yeah, so I go to SciTech. In the first year, we're in the Western Mass Finals at the Cage. And I'm an assistant. I'm like, this is great. I'm like,
the Cage is
UMass. Okay. So that's where the championship game used to be played for Western Mass. Okay. We had a real talented team. We played against Central in the finals. And I'm like, wow, this is awesome. First year, I'm like, we're up at the Cage. So after the first season, I get a phone call from another guy I had coached against when I was coaching freshman. And he's like, hey, I'm at Elms College. I'm leaving, though, to take a high school job. Are you interested in coaching college? And I'm so like, why are we leaving?
You coach against him as he was coaching a freshman high school.
He was coaching a freshman team. His journey, the next couple of years led him to Elms as an assistant. So he was leaving here to take a varsity high school job. To some, it's a step down, but to others, that's a move. Okay. You're going to be in the leader versus just being an assistant. For sure. So I'm like, geez, all right, I really want to be in college, coaching. You're dealing with grown men versus dealing with high school kids.
No equal playing time, none of that BS.
No, none of that. I'm like, yeah. It's, you know, I'm 20, I want to say 27 at the time, 26 at the time. I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. Like, so I come in, I meet with Coach Silva, who's a Hall of Famer here, legendary coach. And, you know, he sits me down. We talk about, you know, what my beliefs are as a coach, and basically says to me, you know, I'd like to have you come join the staff as a volunteer assistant. And I'm thinking, all right, you don't get paid. I'm like, but he's like, but I'd also like you to finish your degree, which to me, I'm like, all right, well, I hate school, but if I'm coaching at Elms and I'm going to Elms, maybe I'll like it better. So yeah, that's kind of how I ended up here. And it's been 15 years since then.
When you were going through high school and college, were you actively thinking about becoming a coach, or was there other paths that you could have taken that you were looking at?
I did. I loved coaching. I just, like I said, ever since the moment in high school where my coach sat me down and really like humbled me, like the passion for being a coach is kind of like, I'm like, wow, I really love working with kids, which is why I'm a teacher. And I really love coaching, but I'm always, like in my mind, I'm always the guy that I can't lie to you. I got to tell it like it is. And sometimes people don't like that. Players don't like to be told like what it is. And that's where there's a fine line between, you know, you either, like you said earlier, like there's probably, when I said to you, 20% like me, and then there's 80% that don't, and the 20% that do, hey, you know what it is? I'm going to be a straight shooter and be honest with you. That's just the way it is.
How are you financially supporting yourself through? So you, after you graduated from Stick, now you're, what are you career-wise doing in addition to coaching the freshman team? And or like, were you a teacher the whole time? Or how are you kind of supporting yourself through that coaching journey?
So what I did is I became a paraprofessional in the Springfield schools.
That is?
So you're working as an assistant, teacher's assistant.
So who is saying that? Did someone say that on the podcast before?
Can't recall.
I feel like somebody was just telling me something similar.
It's tough. I mean, you don't make a lot of money. You don't get paid during the holidays. You don't get paid over break. You only get really paid the days you're working, so there's no extra incentives. Mm-hmm. So I was doing that. I was volunteer coaching here. But, you know, I was in my 20s. But, yeah, it wasn't that big of a struggle. I mean, I didn't have a lot of expenses then. And I was driving around a beater, and like my car was like, you know,
eating ramen.
Yeah, I'm blessed. I have two parents that really supported me. I had a grandmother who helped me out a lot. I lived with her for a little bit when I was trying to figure out life. Yeah.
So how many years have you been at Elms now?
This is 15. So I've been here. This is year 15 for me. Yeah.
How do you think you evolved as a coach from that first high school job into the second high school job, and now in your 15th year at Elms? How has it sort of progressed for you? What skills have you picked up? What lessons have you learned?
All right. So when I first started as a freshman coach and a high school coach, I think I was more like trying to be to please everyone and trying to like keep everybody happy. As far as the players, the parents, I didn't really care about, because at the end of the day, you're always going to have parents that are not going to like the way things are going. Everyone, and myself as a father now, I understand that like everyone's going to put their child first. So I understand that you're always going to have the parent that doesn't agree with the way their child's being handled as far as playing time. But it's now, I just want, like, I like the fact that being like honest with the kids. And like, my thing is like, I try to hold everybody to an elite standard. So I've been here long enough to see, I want to say there's at least 4 Hall of Famers. And I try to look at the work ethic of those guys and how they grinded every day and the level of competitiveness they had. And I try to push the other guys to that level. And maybe it's wrong, but for me, it's like, that's my expectation. My expectation is the Hall of Famer. And if you have the player at the end of the bench working as hard as the Hall of Famer, they're not going to be the Hall of Famer probably, but they're going to be a lot better than they were to start with. And that's where I think my biggest disagreement with some guys is when they don't push themselves to reach their full potential. And that's like, if you're going to do something, and maybe that's why I was, like I said, I was never the greatest player, but my mindset was, I'm going to give you everything I got and I'm going to give you 100%. And I'm going to give my team 100%. And if that's not good enough, you know, it is what it is. But
you said you saw four Hall of Famers. Are there other things outside of the work ethic that they had that allowed them to be Hall of Famers that separated them from that last guy on the bench?
Leadership. Like the four guys that I'm talking about.
Who are the four guys?
So Andre French, who just went into the Hall of Fame. Then they're probably the best player, in my opinion, to ever play here. They call him Bags, but his name is Juan Maldonado. He's now the coach at Hoyo Pack.
He's a leading scorer, right?
Yes. Yeah. Hardest worker I've ever seen. Best leader I've ever seen. He has the total package as a person. And to this day, we have a great relationship. Juan Alvario, who I don't know if you guys have met yet. I don't think he's come to a game since you guys have been here. Another one. Just brought everything every day. And like just good people too. I think to be a Hall of Famer, I think you have to have the complete package. Like, yeah, you're going to have, there's some guys who have an attitude, but I think if you have that attitude, it holds you back. So I don't like that. Those are the characteristics from the four guys that I know who are Hall of Famers. It's just, they were the ultimate leader, ultimate teammate, and they're just great people. And then the fourth one is Coach Silva, who was a head coach here, is the all-time winningest coach here. He's now up at the University of New England, up in Maine. So, I mean, that's the common.
And another dynamic. One is potentially going to be TC, who I feel like embodies a lot of the characteristics of the other four Hall of Famers who you were just talking about, in the leadership, the work ethic. Great person, things like that. So shout out TC.
Yeah.
Before we get off the topic, I want to just know, like, before I forget. So as a 19-year-old coach coaching high school kids, these kids are like 14, maybe some of them are older, 15. You're 4 or 5 years older than them. Do you feel like you had a stronger influence because you were closer to their age so they could relate to you more, or kind of like a negative influence? Because like, yo, this guy's barely older than me. Like, why the hell am I going to listen to him? I feel like there you could kind of go down both avenues. So like, kind of, what was your experience?
When I was...
If you can remember.
A freshman. No, what's crazy is my best relationships with my players are with those guys.
Yeah,
the ones who were 19, when I was 19 and they were 14, 15, to this day, I still talk to them, still see them. One of them came and took a look at my backyard, was gonna do some work for my house. Like, there's others I see out all the time. It's just, I think because I was learning and they were real young, that like our relationship was so strong. Okay. And they would run through a wall for me. It was just like, I was only a couple years older and they didn't wanna let me down. It wasn't like, I don't know. And at that point, I don't know if I was their coach, more so that I was like a big brother to them that was coaching them.
I feel like with that, I guess, age difference, there's kind of so many different like roads you could kind of go down. I mean, because the last couple of summers I spent coaching at various camps. And I guess the more experience as a coach you get and the more time you've been at the company, the higher level kids you would get. And I feel like some of the kids who I would coach at the lower level camps, I guess, would not as, I guess, respect the coaches as much, because I guess at the end of the day, we're all 18, 19, some of the coaches are 17, and these kids are however old. But then, like, as you get to the higher level camps, like, they just want to soak in all of the knowledge, and like, they don't care how old you are. Like, I was, let's just say, 3 years older than some of the kids who I was coaching, and these kids are like going to be like future, like, very good players. But like, those are the kids that would listen to me the most, if that makes sense.
No, it does, 100%.
One of the things I asked Southall, and I'm wondering if I can get your take on this too, is leading with negative reinforcement versus positive reinforcement and how you feel like your style of leadership is.
All right. So I feel like I've transitioned over the last couple of years. I was very negative in my early stages here. Like, I expected like 100% out of everybody at all times. And like, you know, but then, I don't know, I kind of had to change the last couple of years. Like, this, you start to view it as, all right, this is the roster. This is who we have. What can we do to maximize each person's individual talents to get the most out of the team? And it wasn't always like that. Like I said, my first couple of years, I'd be like, Coach knows about this story, but I lost my mind. We had one kid who refused to play. The trainer said he could play. He refused to play, said his ankle hurt. And that night, I received a text message with a picture of him ice skating. And I lost my mind on him in the locker room after a game because I knew that. And I'm like, this kid does not love the game. Like, and I lost it on him. I'm like, I can't respect you as a player that you sat out a game saying your ankle hurt and you're ice skating that night. Like, but yeah, that was at that the early stages here. That was my biggest like downfall, is that I expected everybody to be at that elite level, and then more so now I understand that like we got to get everybody, you know, because you're only as good as the, for here it's the 22nd guy. You're only as good as that guy. If that guy works his tail off and reaches his full potential, your team is going to reach their full potential.
With that ice skating incident, do you think that drove the player away from you to sort of just shut him off? Like, he's kind of an asshole, I'm not going to listen to him anymore. And that's just pushed it even farther away.
Oh, yeah. We were done after that. And I'm not going to lie. I had lost respect for that player.
That's kind of insane.
Yeah.
He was ice skating.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to say that, like, he walked by and, like, kicked his ankle to see if it was actually spraying.
No.
That's kind of insane, though, to sit out of a game.
No, Coach
Hack. Was he a player that, like...
Yes, he was a very good player.
Yo, Coach Hack would have had a fucking aneurysm if he heard about that. Like, our coach last year was the exact same way. If he saw... He would regularly come into the training room and just scream at the guys, "You're a pussy, you're a pussy, you're a pussy." And he would just light up everybody because they were all, like, in their knees taped and everything. And that was his thing, too. But
yeah, that's crazy. If you're going to be a college basketball player and commit every day, then, like, just commit to it. Like, that's insane.
Another thing we regularly ask people is, do you have any crazy coaching stories through your years of coaching various levels of basketball that are preferably a little appropriate for the podcast?
So, back in 2011, Coach Silva was still the coach here, and we had gotten our butt kicked twice during the season by Becker College. We used to be in the NECC. And Becker College and us were, you know, the powers of the conference. Becker, two regular season games, it wasn't even close. And we're going into the conference playoffs. We win our first two rounds. We meet them in the finals again. And, you know, you get your butt kicked twice. Like, you're not walking in too confident. And I made a joke to our head coach at one of the practices. And I said, "Hey, you know, it's really tough to beat a team three times." And he kind of looked at me and he goes, "Is it? You know, because if they... Is it? Because if you're that good, you know, you should be able to handle the same team three times." So we go into the conference championship, and we kick the living shit out of Becker. We kick the living shit out of him. So we're in the locker room. Everyone's hugging and, like, celebrating. And he looks at me, and he goes, "It's hard to beat a team three times." But what I think what made it even more special is my grandmother had just passed away a week before, as well as the grandmother of one of the Hall of Famers, the Juan Alvieri, who I had mentioned. And it was just a special moment where he gave me a hug and said that, you know, our grandparents were watching from up top. And it was that's a moment I'll never forget here. That would probably be the craziest, just because of, like, you know, to beat them after just, I mean, I think they beat us by like 18 and like 16, and neither one were that close. I would say that. And then on the opposite side, this is more of a sad story. I got a phone call. Rob would know the exact date, but it was probably about 10 years ago. We get a phone call that it's a Saturday night. My phone rings at 4 in the morning. And when your phone's ringing at 4 in the morning, that's never good. And it was one of my former players at SciTech telling me that one of our Elms players had died in a car accident that night. And we had gotten four friends all to come over from STIC, a great class. This was going to be one of our better class. They were all JUCO transfers, had good careers. And one of them was with a friend and ended up passing away in the car accident. And it was five days into the beginning of the season, and it ruined everything. The whole season was just, it was just sad. And it was like, out of the other three guys, I mean, maybe one of them had a good career here. The other two, they never recovered. And these were four guys that were going to be really good. But yeah, those are the two experiences that I'll never forget. That and the fact, I mean, I did meet my wife here, so I would be probably in trouble if I didn't say that was a pretty good experience. I know it's not coaching, but yeah.
So over your 15-year career here, you've seen the team you've seen a lot of good teams and some not so good teams. What do you think this current Elms team needs to do in order to reach that level that those other teams did?
The best teams I've seen here were selfless. Everything was about the team. Now, don't get me wrong, there were some super talented guys with egos, but they would put that aside to win. And I think those are when your best teams are formed, when everybody just they forget about their high school career. They forget about where they've come from or what, you know, what their stats look like. And they just push each other to be the best team as a whole. We had a team a couple years back where we started the season with, I think at the time we were carrying 20. And we ended up having 8 guys, maybe 9 guys, either get injured or quit. And we were not talented. We made it all the way to, was the conference semifinals or the finals, because we had 11 guys that all loved each other and would do anything they could for each other. And that team started winning games. Like, it was the craziest thing. Like, one of the least talented teams at Elms College, but we were winning games because everybody pushed for each other. Mm-hmm. All the drama was gone. And it just, that's what I feel like this team has a lot of talent. It's just getting everybody on the same page and understanding that, yeah, tomorrow night you might score 20, and then the next game you might have 0. And that 0 might be just as important for us as the 20 you had the night before. And it's hard to get 18 to 20-year-olds, or in Jake's case, a little bit older than that, but to believe in that all the time, because, you know, you got people at home being like, oh, you know, why aren't you playing? Or why did you only play 5 minutes tonight versus, you know, 25 minutes last night? And it's hard for kids. I wouldn't want to be a kid today. So
it's been pretty rare in my experience to see a team where they're all less talented, but everything starts to click. And it's way more fun to be on those teams too. Like, you could have 18 guys who are super talented, but they all hate each other. It's like, they probably win games, but it's not super fun to play with them. Like, it's just, there's a negative energy in the room.
Won't reach the potential. Like, you need some sort of chemistry. Mm-hmm. Like, that fighting for each other, that, like, giving it all for the person next to you is such a powerful thing. I think a lot of, like, the great teams, when you look like the Warriors dynasty, like, those guys would die for, like, Draymond would die for any of those guys, and he'd go out and have 0 points and 0 anything. Like, he'd die for them. And, like, that's the passion is really what drives a lot of, like, that success, I feel like.
Another thing I'm wondering is, in terms of personalities on the team and skill sets, what do you think are some of your strengths that sort of help prop up some of Southall's weaknesses and Coach O's weaknesses, and how do you guys sort of complement each other as coaches?
So I think, I don't know, Coach Southall is, I mean, I've loved my time here with him. He's such a good person. I mean, he puts family first, and I think that's a big core value of mine. He's, you know, he loves building the team chemistry with the guys. Sometimes I tell him all the time, he's too nice to the guys. And, like, you got to, like, some of these guys need to be, like, some guys need to be told what they're doing wrong and kind of laid into. And, like, you know, it come off as, you know, people think I'm too negative sometimes. But at the end of the day, if you don't know what you're doing wrong, or you don't, like, understand, and, like, everyone's positive, positive, positive with you, sometimes you need a little negative to get kicked in the butt and get you to work harder, get you to work on the things you're not doing right. And as far as Coach O, I love Coach O. Coach O, he's the best dressed on the team. He's always got the new sneakers. But he's the perfect fit here. I think the three of us kind of fit together well and bring different elements to the coaching staff. But that starts at the top. It starts with Coach Southall. He's, like I said, he's a great leader. He puts a lot of heart and, like, soul into this. I mean, I don't think people don't understand, like, him doing the extra jobs he's doing now. Like, this guy's putting his family aside, and he's spending all this time at Elms College. And, like, it's, you know, sometimes I feel like we don't always appreciate that and see that, like, how much he's putting
in. Shout out, Coach. This is kind of a question we ask a lot of our older, I guess, obviously not the kids or, like, our teammates, yeah. But how has having a kid or, like, change your perspective on things? Well, first, I feel like that's really a big thing for a lot of the parents that we've had on the podcast.
Yeah, we've had players here who had kids, which was a little bit challenging because, you know, they had some stuff they got to do, and basketball is not obviously right. First anymore. For me, my son was born on 41, and everything's changed. Like, it's my wife is the champion at home. Like, I'm telling you right now, like, she is the champion. I don't know how she does it, especially when I'm gone. We have games. I umpire. I got other things that I do, and she's the champ. But it's yeah, just now everything in my life is you know, to make him proud and, you know, try to spend as much time with him as I can. I don't always do the best job. It's hard. I got a lot going on. And especially when we're in October to March. But yeah, it's gotta be hard for any, especially a college kid, to deal with that. And
it's maybe a little random and off topic, but I have it beside the parent question, which is in terms of sleep training. Like I've heard parents talk about sleep training where it's like you just let your kid cry it out. And like as a parent, some people are against that, some people are for that in terms of just like letting the kid deal with it by himself. Do you let him cry it out? Do you go make sure you coddle him right away? Like what is your strategy there?
I would let him cry all night. But my wife, she spends 90% of the night in that rocking chair. Like I said, she's the champion at home. This boy has the best outfits. Like he has the best meals. He has like for daycare, he has like, he's getting rocked to sleep. She reads him books all the time.
What's your son's name?
Jackson.
Shout out Jackson.
So he just, yeah, he hasn't made, but yeah, she will not, if he cries for 2 seconds, she's already picked him up. We're in the rocking chair. So.
There are conflicting theories about that, where it's like if you let him cry it out, it's like you're kind of teaching him that if he cries or has any emotions, then that's negative. And then if you coddle him too much, then it's like, it's just, I've heard too much. Please, I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Fuck. What was I gonna say? Lost my train of thought.
I was gonna go into recruiting for next year. What your? Because you're sort of. Is he the main recruiter here? Or
I do most of the local stuff. Mm-hmm. So I know Coach South. I used to go down to Florida and Maryland. He goes to a lot of the showcases. I teach in the Springfield schools, so I'll do most of the stuff locally. Mm-hmm. Here in Connecticut. This year. We have a lot of guys returning. So there's a couple guys we're out there recruiting, but it's not like it's been in years past where there's this big class we're out trying to get. But yeah, most of the time over the course of my time here, it's been local.
So what are your strategies and what are you looking to address going into this offseason in terms of recruiting players?
So first thing, I want to know how you are when shit hits the fan. I want to know how you are on a bad shooting night. I want to know how you are when you're not playing. And that's the first thing when I go to a game, I'll watch how you interact with your family. I'll watch how you interact with your coach. I mean, basketball is basketball. Like if I'm going to watch you, I know you're at least talented. You know, I've gotten a phone call or I've seen a video, but I want to know your character. Like, cause without your character, like, yeah, I mean, you can't get better and you can't develop if you're not a good person. I think that's a quality you have to have. Am I saying that there's not great players out there who aren't kind of jerks? No, there are. There's, we've had one here, but yeah.
Only one jerk player here? Any from that?
No, we've had like great players. We've had one who was.
I feel like I've heard some stories on the bus while I was drifting in and out of sleep.
Not to get off topic, we had one player here who like was unbelievable. Like when I say really good, he was really good. Best player in the conference. Broke an NCAA record or D3 record. He scored 16 points in 2.5 minutes on the night he needed 1,000. Like, broke some crazy record. This kid was unbelievable. And he was just a hard teammate to get along with. Like, I'll never forget this. In the locker room one time, he called a kid out who's another player who's potentially up for the Hall of Fame in a year or two and said, "We're not winning because you didn't get better. And I need you to get better to help me win." And like, just like the way he would treat his teammates was like, it was tough. Like a lot of people couldn't handle it.
Do you think he was in the wrong for saying that? Was that guy the reason that we weren't getting better?
Yeah. I mean, he was saying it to a potential Hall of Famer, but yeah, he was, you know, I mean, there's times he'd walk into the huddle and tell the team, get him the ball and get the blank out of the way. And like he was very talented. He put in a lot of work, but his leadership skills lacked a little bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, over the my rest of the time here, there's guys, but at the end of the day, like it's my job and other coaches' job to try to maximize those guys and try to figure out ways to bring out their strengths. You know, some are harder than others.
Last year, we definitely had a few guys who were definitely on the harder side of things where they'd be in the huddle and just locked in and scream at you in practice. And it would, I'm wondering in my own head right now if it was a helpful asset to the team or if it sort of hurt things. Because we already had a coach who was super intense. And then you add on top of that two or three players who are sort of just matching his energy. And sometimes they would, the coach and the players would go back and forth. And then that was a battle. And then it was just, so I think it was more negative.
Yeah, I can give you a short answer. Definitely negative. As we just talked about, like the chemistry thing is so important. And if you just, if player A just yelled at player B and told him, we're not winning because of you. And player B goes on the court after the timeout and it's like, fuck this guy. And then you don't have those two people playing for each other, which is that like special thing that can really drive a team of nine dudes who are probably would not be winning in other circumstances to the conference finals.
But I think it is helpful to have at least one guy. And it has to be the right guy, though, too, because you can't be an asshole if you're the last guy on the bench, because the first guy on the bench is not, the first guy that's getting started is not going to listen
to you. It's just you have to like, it's not even necessarily being an asshole. It's just like, keep it real, as you said. It's like, if someone's not carrying their load, especially like, even like getting work in, then you got to like, keep it real.
Or cut them loose.
Different methods.
So next thing I have here is lifting. So I understand that you were fairly overweight for a decent period of time. And I'm wondering how you made a 180.
Yeah. So, all right. So COVID was really bad for some people. But for me, and I've been saying this, COVID changed my life, for multiple ways. And they were all positive. I was in the gym every single day following a routine. We'll start the story with this. So when COVID hit, obviously everything closed. I was working for a program called Scholar Athletes. So I was in a high school. This was after I was a para for 8 years. The Scholar Athlete Program opened up in the Springfield Public Schools. I'm like, wow, this is great. I get to help kids go to college. We're dealing with sports. I'm bringing in tutors and stuff to work with kids. And COVID hits and it closes. So I'm like, all right, you know, we're at home. There's nothing going on. Nobody's working. I'm like, I got to lose some weight. So first I tried, I don't know if you ever tried sugar detox.
I've done it. It's a little rough.
It was a little rough. And when you're 285 pounds, it was really rough. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to die. I can remember laying on the couch, cold sweat dripping down my face. And this is day two.
Because you're taking
no sugar.
No sugar. Your brain's created. It's no
how
sugar.
Do you,
so
what are you eating?
Meat and vegetables.
Meat and vegetables, eggs.
Rice.
So it's just like.
Not sugar. You can have carbs. I wasn't even, you just can't have sugar.
I wasn't even eating rice. That's so crazy.
You had no carbs?
No carbs.
Okay.
And no sugar.
Too. I've done everything under the like fucking
keto,
sun. Kind
of. It was keto. So that's what I was doing. I was doing keto, sweating, unable to move, thought I would have to go to the hospital. My wife thought I was going to die. So she's like, what the heck? So this was going on for like 2 days. I'm like, what in the world have I done? I'm just going to go eat some like, I don't know, candy bar or something. Like I need some sugar. So I got through day three. And I'm like, well, I feel a little bit better on day four. By day five, I'm like, I feel great.
Mm-hmm. You got ketosis.
Yeah. Then I'm like, wait a minute. I'm starting to lose a little bit of weight here, a little bit of weight there. And then I realized, like, all right, well, I have a routine. I wake up every morning, 6 a.m. And this sounds corny, but I would go to the Starbucks, get a coffee, sit in there for a couple minutes, like 7 o'clock, get my thoughts ready of what I had to do for the day. Like, obviously, I think at that point they were still open a little bit. They could do like drive-through. And then I'm like, shoot. I'm like, all right, what else? Like, I'm up. Let me go to the gym. So day four, I started the gym. The first 3 days, I couldn't even function. Like, if you ever want to try it, try it. You're a lot lighter than I was. So
I've done a 3 day fast before. Like, I've been in, once you get to that like 72 hour mark, everything starts to get real clear and your head starts, but those first few days are very rough.
I go most days without eating sugar. I just like genuinely gravitate to meat, potatoes, vegetables, healthy foods.
Yeah.
So I could do that fine. Although, so I'm Jewish, and the Jewish holiday Yom Kippur, you do fast for 27 hours. So I do know those feeling of like lying in bed, completely depleted of every nutrients, mm-hmm. like just feeling like, not friendly.
No. And this was, I think this was in January. Wait, when did
COVID started in March of 2020, right?
March of 2020. So COVID went through. So this was December of 2020, the end of 2020, is when I started this journey.
So were you overweight before COVID or during COVID you put on a lot of weight?
No, I was overweight before COVID. I was 285, 86 pounds.
And you're 6 foot
I'm 5'10". And like the pictures, people see pictures of me back then and they're like, that's not you. Like my driver's license, I don't have it on me. I get all the time. I haven't got a new one yet. People are like, this isn't you. But so it was December. I started working out, did the same routine every single day. I would get up, get a coffee, get my thoughts, eat my breakfast, which was the same thing. It was like eggs. My wife would make me eggs every morning. It would be like eggs and like a couple pieces of bacon. Coach Salto can attest. I would bring like all this bacon on the bus. I would eat that, be at the gym every morning for 11, work out 11 to 1, come home, eat, and do the same thing for the next 6 months. And in 6 months, I went from 285, 86 to 180.
Wow. You lost 100 pounds in 6 months.
Yes.
Shout out keto.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, I had other motives. My wedding was coming. My wedding ended up getting moved to 2021. But yeah, so it was like.
And you just kept going ever since.
Yeah, I went to 180. I felt a little lean at 180. I didn't like it. You know, when people saw my picture, they were like, nonstop people reach out to me on Facebook. Hey, can you help me out? Like, what'd you do? I'm like, well, what I did probably isn't the healthiest. But right now, like 205, I like being in the 200 range. 180 was just too lean for me, and too like you feel weak. Like,
hey,
you
know, some of us are 180 and don't feel weak.
No, but when you're 285,
I get it.
The funniest story is I obviously have a bigger head, and when I went to get my fitted for the wedding, they fit me when I was 285, but the wedding got pushed another year because of COVID. So I go back, my neck size was fit at almost a 20, like 19 something. When they went back a year later, it was a 16 and a half. And the guy weighing it, I was like, you lost 3 inches in your neck. And I'm like, holy shit.
What specifically were you doing in the gym when you showed up on that first day?
Oh, the first day? I mean, I had no energy. Okay. Because I wasn't eating carbs. I would just do light weights and then like cardio. Knowing what I know now, I would have obviously eaten a lot more protein. I would have obviously eaten some carbohydrates. I would have stayed away from the added sugars and like, you know, keto worked for me, but I don't push it on anybody else just because I think you're leaving out some serious nutrients. Yeah. And where I'm at today, I feel way healthier than I did when I lost 100 pounds. But saying that, it changed my life. I mean, if you guys don't know me at 285, I'll show you a picture after.
I've seen the picture before.
I look like a different person. But yeah, my energy levels, my sleep. I had sleep apnea. That was gone.
It's very common for overweight people.
Yeah. Back pain, gone. I even had I was on a breathing machine when I was 285. My doctor gave me the sleep apnea breathing machine and like, I didn't, when I was down to 185, I'm like, shoot, no more snoring, no nothing.
What are you doing now in terms of lifting, and do you have goals in that area now?
Didn't you say you're doing some Arizona bodybuilding show?
I was going to say, I heard about a bodybuilding show. I didn't know if that was true or not.
No, my dream is to do a bodybuilding show at some point. That being said, I work out every single day. I try to lift as heavy as I can and progressively overload.
My favorite two words in the English language.
Yeah. I'm like, but my genetics are not the best. I mean, naturally, this is about as strong as I'm going to look. I mean, you see people in the gym and you're just like, yeah.
Are you thinking about?
Never.
Going down the?
Never.
I wish I could say the same.
Yeah, never. No interest at all.
Do you have any advice? Because Chris will constantly walk in. So Chris will go take his, he'll literally shower on the hottest possible thing that his skin comes out red after. He'll come out with his towel over his thing. He's like, bro, I need to start pinning. He was just looking at himself in the bathroom mirror for 20 minutes before getting into the shower, and then I'll be playing my game or I'll be doing whatever, and he'll be like, I need to start pinning. Like, I need to. So do you have any advice for him?
What
kind of convince him to stay natural, kind of talk him off the ledge?
Oh, that's what pinning is? I'm sorry, I'm old.
Pinning is taking steroids. So all right. Here's the thing.
Right? I thought it was gear. That's another word I heard. All right.
I'm in the midst of a cut, right? Like, I can't speak English right now. I was at the peak of my bulk, 220 pounds. I'm currently 193. So I was quite fat. But I got down to 193. I'm about, like, I had to guess 13% body fat right now. I'm trying to get down to, like, 10% body fat. But when you're on a cut, the only time you look big is when you're in the gym. And then the other 24 hours of the day, you're like, Holy shit, I'm small as fuck. Because you've seen when you're in the bulk, it's peaked, your muscles are full of glycogen, everything. So it's like, you'll be on Instagram scrolling. I'm like, man, life would be so much easier if I just, it's a little bit of year, a little bit of, at some point in the near future, I have a buddy back home who's currently on two SARMs, and he's going to debate maybe hopping on testosterone later this year. I would maybe do it if I knew more about this stuff, but we'll see in the near future.
I mean, to be honest with you, everything changed for me once I had a son. Then my mind shifted on stuff like that. Because obviously everything's...
But longevity.
Longevity. I mean, my whole thing is, and like, this might sound corny, I want to be the most in shape 50-year-old on the planet. I'm 42 now. Mm-hmm. That's my goal. My goal is 8 years from now.
We had a 50-year-old.
All right.
That's dunking.
Dunking?
Actively, yeah.
Well, I'll never be able to dunk. I don't have the genetics.
His name is David Rudnick, and he owns the basketball company that I worked for.
Yeah.
And he's one of my very close friends' dads, and so we had him on the show, talked about some stuff, talked about weightlifting, and his goal was he wants to dunk till he's 50. I think he dunked to 50, so you got some competition. Mm-hmm.
Some TRT could really help trying to get in this testosterone replacement therapy. After you're 50, you're not
having any more kids. I got eight more years.
No worries. You don't have to have kids. You don't have to worry about fertility. It's perfect.
You got to worry about living to raise your kids.
You'll be fine. TRT is great for you. There's so many benefits. You won't have to worry about a thing. What do I have here? Oh, this is another one I wanted to talk about because I'd assumed at some point you would experience this. So do you have a rock bottom moment / story that you could tell and what it taught you? Maybe it's when you were 285. Maybe it was coming out of high school, getting fired from that job.
Yeah, I mean, the rock bottom as far as coaching was the phone call that I got that a player had passed away. I've never experienced that, and that's a moment I can still remember to this day, the phone ringing. That's not that's something I'll never forget. I think my rock bottom would have to be my moment at St. Mary's. You know, I was so excited to coach there, and it was, I was still relatively young, and I loved it there. The kids were great. Same situation. We have great relationships to this day. I still talk to a lot of those kids there. And when that happened, and it hurt me a lot to part ways with them, but it also taught me that you have to stand on your own beliefs and your own. Ground. Like, you can't just budge because someone else wants you to. And, you know, that's something that I'll never forget. And it's something that's helped to mold me to today. I'll go back to the story I told you guys earlier about how long it's taken me. And a lot of people don't know this, and I haven't told guys on the team publicly. I just graduated during COVID from Elms. So I don't know if you guys know who David Kimball is.
Yep.
Yeah. So David Kimball saved my life. Like, I owe him everything. And he's one of the reasons I absolutely love this college, and I have no plans on leaving here anytime soon. He has stuck by me since the minute I walked on this campus in 08, 09. And he's, you know, I was taking a class here, a class there. It literally took me from 08 to 09 to get my degree in 2020.
Wow.
Just one at a time. Two at a time. And he did everything he could to help me out. We stayed in contact. He would just, you know, hey, Jay, let's get this one class in. I know you're working, you know, two jobs and you don't have any time. Let's try to get this one class and that one class. The perseverance there is, it's like, I don't know. It's just like, it was so gratifying in 2020. And that's how I became a teacher. It opened the door into teaching. I needed my degree to become a teacher. I'm like, you know, I'm making para money, then I'm working with scholar athletes. And I'm like, you know, teaching money is just different. You know, you get extra opportunities. There's just a lot of different ways to make more revenue with teaching. And I had to get my degree. And you know, like I said, if it wasn't for David Kimball, that's never happening.
We talk about it a lot in this podcast, how if you needed a sales pitch for Elms, there is a weird sense of family that's here that I didn't notice at the other colleges that I've been to, which is sort of, I don't know. I can't say if it's out of the ordinary for regular college because I've only been to two colleges in my life, but there is a really good sense of family here and people actually care about you, and there's the teachers know your name and they talk to you in between the hallways. It's very family oriented here. Another thing I want to bring up here is, so I'm doing a sales internship in the summer, and I've been watching a lot of podcasts and TikTok reels and everything, and people keep talking about the fear of uncertainty and sort of traversing into this territory that you have no idea what you're doing. I've never tried to sell anything in my life. I'm just heading down this path because I'm 20 and I'm going to try shit and see what works and whatever. Do you have a memory where you can recall stepping into a role or something where you had no idea what you were doing, but it ended up paying off dividends much later in your life?
Actually, it's the job I'm at now. Right after the scholar athletes thing happened and COVID happened, I got a phone call from a gentleman who was at Central High School. He's assistant principal. And he had been with at Commerce years ago when I was first started being a para. And he's like, Jay, you interested in coming to Central? We have an opportunity that'll be opening up once the kids start coming back to school from COVID. He goes, I'm going to bring you in as a para to finish the last couple of months because school opened back up in like March or April for in-person. And the kids came in, finished the year at Central. And then the next year they came back in person again. And so I went in as a para from March till the end of the school year, or April to the end of the school year. And then at the end of the year, they're like, hey, you know, are you interested in being a teacher? And I'm like, yeah, that's, you know, that was the, when I finished school, but my degree's in business though, you know, how would I be a teacher? And do you have to go take any other courses? They're like, no, if you can handle kids, we can make you into a teacher. And I'm like, huh? I'm like, this, you know, it's kind of, sounds kind of intimidating. Like I'm, you know, what would I teach? And they're like, well, do you know any math? I was like, yeah, but I haven't taken math since I was 18, 17 years old. Like, so they offered me an opportunity to come in on a waiver to teach Algebra 1 and Geometry. And the first day, I'm like, whoa, this is nuts. Like, I got kids in front of me. I'm like, I'm learning, they're learning. And now, 3 years later, it's been the best thing that's ever happened to
me. You're still teaching
math. I am. Yeah, I'm teaching Algebra 1 for freshmen.
How confident were you with that material teaching them? Or is it just like...
We were both learning together again. Because, I mean, I knew the material from years ago.
Of course.
But I, like I said, I didn't love school, like, at all. Like, I just didn't. Like, it wasn't my thing. Like, I had... I have two sisters. One sister is just like me. We love sports. And she kind of likes school. I didn't like school. I love sports. And our other sister didn't really like sports, but loves school. So that's kind of that. When I first got there, I'm like, geez, we're learning together. These freshmen are looking at me and I'm like afraid to make a mistake on the board. And I'm like relearning the material 20 years later. And, but it's outside of getting married and having a kid, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. It really is.
Mildly ironic. The guy that hated school ended up back becoming a teacher who's now teaching at the school.
Yeah, no. And like I said, I owe it to, you know, COVID, it did things for my life. Yeah, I know it had a lot of negatives, but for my life, it's been it was one of the best things that helped shape me was that ability to just self-reflect and be at home and kind of get my life in order.
I feel like that's a very big trend. Like a lot of people took a lot of steps in a positive direction or a lot of steps in a negative direction, and that's, I guess.
Before we get into the last two questions here, I want to go, because I think this gives me a lot of insight into who and them, who you are as a person. What is your idea of a perfect day?
Ooh. All right, so perfect day. I'm getting up early. I'm a big coffee guy, and I'm a big country roads guy. I love just going for a ride in middle of nowhere, like 6 o'clock in the morning, windows down.
Bailey's in the coffee.
It's no Bailey's. No. I'm a country music guy. I love country.
Speaking my language.
Maybe listening to Ships Across the Border.
Going for a ride, getting a coffee, going to the gym. And then honestly, just, I try to get my wife all the time. I love to go for hikes. I love being outside, anything outside. And then finishing the day with, you know, watching some basketball, or if we're in season, usually it's cold, we're in season. So those two days are different. Yeah. You know, and then I said, you know, now it's a little different. Now it's spending time with my son, with my wife, but yeah, that's pretty much it.
Very simple.
Yeah. I like things simple, and I try to keep everything orderly and have a routine, because that's what's been successful for me is the routine.
We just before we wrap it up,
we got to.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So before we ask our last question, what do you want your legacy to be? So you talk about
a question from Denisha Parks. You left it from the last episode. Right.
I just want to be known as somebody that players could count on, like. I've tried to, my big thing here is I've always tried to...
1 second,
let's just leave it.
Still recording.
Keep going, yeah, keep going.
I've tried to, like, do my best to be more than a coach for guys, and to make guys feel comfortable being able to ask me anything, and being able to lean on me if they need something years later. And I think that's what I want, because I'm not the head coach here. And it's okay if players have different relationships with, you know, different coaches, you know, obviously, you know. And I can – I've always tried to be the guy that, like, if a player is dealing with something that they feel comfortable going to, if it's bigger than basketball, and just trying to be there for them. I really love having relationships with players years later, and where they can, like, feel like, hey, Coach P, like, you know, I need help with a job, or I need a reference or something. And I think that's where it makes me understand, like, and feel – like, because let's be honest, Elms College, it's a small school, and there are, it has positives and negatives, but we said earlier, one of the biggest positives is the ability, the family environment here, and the relationships that are built here is different than any other place that I've been to.
So our normal last question would be, what is one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self? But I sort of reframe this because I think it sounds better. I think you'll have a better answer for this. So what advice would you give to me and Max, two 20-year-olds who have their entire life ahead of us? What would you tell us right now?
It goes by fast, man. Like, I can, like, anything you can do today, do it. And don't put it off to tomorrow, because it goes by fast. Like, this, I can remember, like, being 21, like, the time of my life, like, just doing whatever I wanted. And, like, I look back on it, I'm like, wow, I'm 42 years old. And, it, like that, man. And it's like, yeah, that's how I'd say. Don't, anything you can do today, or if you have any, like, things you're, like, travel, do, like, any jobs you're interested in, any continuing education, just do it now. Because you want to be able to enjoy life when you're in your 30s. And 40s, and not have, like, any regrets. And I think that's the biggest thing. It's like, if you told me today I could be a millionaire, or I could go be 21 again, give me 21 all day. Give me 21 all day. I, because you can't get that time back. You can always make that million in the next 20 years, but you can't get those 20 years back.
Okay. That's a great way to end it.
Awesome. Thank you for coming on, Coach.
All right. 65, call it wraps.